Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled Important Historic Jewelry of Valletta. This talk is delivered by Mrs. Francesca Balzan.
Thank you for coming. My first thought was because we are doing the series, as you know, Rediscovering Valletta, and this is the third year running. And I was thinking whether it would be too much to prolong it for next year, for the fourth year. But there's so much about, two or three of you told me, so to discover still about Valletta that most probably I don't know. In any case, then we'll see about it. So this is the penultimate lecture. Francesca has been very kind about 6 months ago to offer her, we'd call it, service this evening. And as you perhaps you have surmised or discovered, the subjects were a bit out of the ordinary. You remember the one we had by Malcolm Nicola de Pilo at the Auberge Castile. In any case, it was nice, and people phoned me up how much they enjoyed it. I hope that this evening you enjoyed just as well, because Francesca, first of all, she is the director of the newly refurbished, wonderfully refurbished Palazzo Falzon. So those who have not visited it should do so at the first opportunity, because it's really worthwhile, something really done, not only professionally, because professionally many times it's a cold undertaking, but as something that comes, how do we call it, labor of love, what has been carried out there. So, and Francesca there is really the expression is the man fit for the job, but she's the woman fit for the job. In the case, so this evening, important historic jewelry in Valletta. Well, I am sure that Francesca is going to delight us with her discoveries and many hidden jewelries, because today I have to pay attention, you know, about once I was going to because I used to write in a local parish newspaper, journal, whatever it is, and I would go to talk about the precious things, and the parish priest wanted to kill me. He said, no, don't you never dare to mention anything about it. So I had to stop it. But of course this evening you already see there the wonderful work of art that our ancestors enjoyed. I hope we still also enjoy them as much as we enjoy, sorry to tell you, beautiful Francesca. And the beauty which is going to she's going to discuss this evening. But sorry, because her papa, we came all the lectures except hers. He decided to go to America, not purposely, but so
isn't that terrible?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Salvatore. And just to put your minds at rest, everything that I'm going to show you is in very, very safe storage. So don't worry. This is exactly why I can't show you the items. Well, by way of introduction, as Salvatore has told you, Francesca Balzan, I'm the curator at Palazzo Falzon. Why did I choose to study jewelry? Well, first and foremost, I needed to choose a subject for my MA, art history dissertation. And as I was casting around to try and find an adequate subject or a subject that I could sort of start to make justice to, I sort of noticed that jewelry hadn't been studied at all. It had been mentioned in studies of, for example, silver, but very peripherally, sort of more like they'd mentioned filigree, silver filigree, but not give it too much attention. So I thought perhaps it's time to actually look at jewelry properly, with address the subject with a proper historical framework. I tried to do it. I don't know if I did justice to the subject, as I should have, but it's a beginning, the very beginning, because as I discovered during the years of research, there is so much in the archives that can be tapped that really, I think, a lifetime will perhaps skim the surface, that's all, of all there is in the to study about historic jewellery. So I'm just going to introduce you to the subject. Hopefully we can all, you know, look more at portraits as a result, detect more items of historic jewellery within portraits, perhaps even in private collections, and start to even appreciate what we might have at home. Now, actually, the subject of this lecture, apart from being jewellery, is Valletta, so I have to talk about Valletta. Well, Valletta was the happening place for jewellery in Night Spirit Malta. Valletta was where it was made, mostly. Valletta was where some of the best pieces of jewellery were being worn. And Valletta is where you will nowadays find some of the finest pieces of historical jewellery on the island. Moreover, archives in Valletta are where you will unearth much of the evidence to build up a jewellery history of Malta. In terms of location prior to the Knights period, it is likely that any goldsmiths working in Malta would have been based in Rabat, on the periphery of Indina, as is the case with other crafts and trades. On the arrival of the Knights, the increased activity in gold and silver smithing may have partially shifted to Birgu and would have been supplemented by the newly arrived Rodiot craftsmen. On the establishment of Valletta, it is likely that the gold and silversmiths too migrated to Valletta with the body of Knights who formed an important part of their clientele. By the mid-17th century, it is clear that most of the gold and silversmiths worked in Valletta bottegas, and these workshops were clustered into one street, which was known as the Goldsmith Street. In later years, they may have spread into the surrounding streets. It is also probable that these artisans not only worked, but also lived in Valletta, as a large amount of jewellers, goldsmiths and silversmiths are mentioned in the different quarters of Valletta in the Rollo of 1750 and 1766. A few are mentioned in Floriana, but this is within walking distance of Valletta. And in at least one instance, a goldsmith both worked and lived in his bottega. Now, I don't quite know the reason for this. Was it the practice at the time for the goldsmith to actually live where he was working? Was it a case that he wasn't earning enough money and he couldn't afford separate accommodation? Or was it perhaps a measure of security? Would you live in your bottega? Would you sleep there to ensure that nobody breaks in at night? I don't know for sure, and hopefully we'll find more evidence to give us an indication of what the answer may have been. But allow me to digress slightly. Archives. This is a subject which is very, very close to my heart, and I'll explain why. Historians in Malta are particularly fortunate to be surrounded with such a wealth of archives. Most are easily accessible during reasonable hours at no cost at all. The only cost is time, and this is richly rewarded by the discoveries one makes as you go through material, which more often than not has not been looked at for years, sometimes even decades, occasionally even centuries. Sometimes you just open a page, clearly the pages are almost stuck together. They haven't been touched, they haven't been thumbed for ages. Occasionally even a hair falls out and you think, oh, there's a connection with the person who would have actually written that document or the last person who would have actually looked at it. It's quite a feeling. I really can't start to explain what a great joy it is to turn these fragile pages and make discoveries in these archives. We have archives of documents in several locations around the island. I personally concentrated mostly on the Banca Giuratale Fond and the Cathedral Archives up at Indina, as well as the library manuscripts and, to a certain extent, the archives of the Order at the Biblioteca here in Valletta. But in Valletta itself, there are other exceptionally rich sources, such as the Notarial Archives, particularly the branch at St. Christopher Street, which contains well over 15,000 registers of notarial records. These provide a picture of Maltese life at all levels of society, in the town and in the country, from the 15th right through to the 20th century. Other important archives in Valletta belong to the various churches. I have consulted the archives of the Confraternity of Our Lady of Charity at the Carmelite Church, and have dipped into the ones at the churches of Porto Salvo and St. Paul Shipwrecked. Several others, sometimes in private collections, such as the important collection of family papers, which are carefully conserved at the Casa Rocca Piccola, are of great importance for our history. Sometimes in archives you do not only find descriptions of artworks, such as inventories. In fact, you can see an example on the right of an inventory which lists jewels. But you also find veritable works of art. For example, take a look at the picture of a notarial document on the left. The initial L of Laus, which is the opening word in the notarial act, is decorated with a grotesque head in profile. Moreover, the margin contains the notary's signum or cipher. Well, notary Enrico Zarf, working in 16th century Malta, chose to depict a jewel in his signum, of all things. But where is all this important jewellery in Valletta? Let's start by analysing the past. Symbolically, the most important building in Knightsbury at Valletta was the Grand Master's Palace. Here was a seat of power. The Grand Master reigned supreme over his knights and subjects from here. But here also lay the Order's treasure house. In the archives of the Order at Biblioteca, just up the road from here, lies the Libro Gioie del Conservatore Conventuale, AOM 900, which details, amongst other things, the gioie to be found in the palace's torretta in 1792, although the tower had actually been used as a treasure store since the late 16th century. The jewels found there ranged from figurative pieces, such as una testa di pesce con perle e diamanti, valued at 370 scudi, to rosaries such as una corona di pietra cordiale con argento, valued at 25 scudi, and a chaplet, una decina d'ambra con argento, valued at 15 scudi. What may have been personal jewellery of the Grand Master, such as un anello inciso con l'arma del fu eminentissimo Verdala, valued at 20 scudi, to jewellery which gives us an idea of the type of cut of the stone, un anello d'oro con un diamante a punta, which was valued at 470 scudi. A diamante a punta probably refers to the pointed cut, one of the earliest forms of cuts for diamonds. A virtual torrent of unmounted diamonds follows in this list. These diamanti sciolti, some of which are indicated as sold to particular persons whose surname is noted, are entered on this ledger with their corresponding values. Incidentally, one of the people who is noted as having bought one of these diamanti sciolti is a certain Camilleri. Was it a Maltese person buying from the Grand Mosque, from the Order's treasury? Or was it perhaps a Sicilian with a surname which sounds like, the very common Camilleri surname? Where did all this jewellery come from? The principal sources would have been the individual spoli of the knights and the booty acquired from the operation of the Corso. Despite their vows of poverty, many knights were actually very wealthy and owned important pieces of jewellery. Evidence of this comes from the inventory of the Conventual Church of the Order, another building of great significance in Valletta. Donations of some exquisite pieces of jewellery, sometimes illustrated in the inventory, and amounting to thousands of scudi, represented pious donations from named knights. The various coverings of the icon of the Virgin of Philermos, one of the most precious relics of the knights, contained just such splendid donations. For example, la croce d'oro a medaglia con sua ligaccia guarniti di diamanti data dal commendatore Cloyac, stimata scudi 735. The red material cover, the vestito di stoffa rossa, probably the one illustrated in Libro Manuscript 362, which you can see in the slide, is noted as bearing una croce d'oro ottagona con 53 diamanti brillanti, cioè 7 grandi, 8 mezzani e 38 piccoli, data alla Beatissima Vergine di Filermo dal Venerando Priore di Barletta Piccolomini, il 19 di aprile 1760, stimata 1000 scudi. So it's clearly a very, very important piece. The third very important building of the order in Valletta was a hospital, or Sagra Infermeria. Not an obvious place to find jewellery, but you'd be surprised where jewellery turns up. Jewellery, for example, is mentioned in the wills of the patients at the Sagra Infermeria, drawn up, no doubt, when the spectre of death hovered above them. But jewelry, or to be more precise, materials which were used in jewelry making, also had a medicinal application. I have found in a highly informative, and by the way, highly entertaining, 18th century book of recipes entitled Giardino di bellissimi segreti e ricette avuti da diversi soggetti bravi e signori, a recipe for tincture using ground coral. Other medico-magical uses of jewellery and gem material which pertain more to the realm of folklore include the belief in Occhi di Serpi, Lingue di San Paolo, and Ugnia di Gran Bestia, or Ungia as well, to alleviate various ailments. Now, the Lingue and the Occhi di Serpi were actually fossils, but they were piously believed to have connections with St. Paul, particularly the Lingue di San Paolo, because they were in the shape of a tongue, they were actually shark's teeth, which were fossilized, and they were held to have curative powers, and powers as well to let's say, counter the effects of poison. So they were used, and they were used in bracelets and on necklaces. Now, the Archbishop's Palace in Valletta, another notorious seat of power, also held jewellery. The famous Emerald Cross of Bishop Alphéron de Boussan, which survives to this day, was at one stage to be found in this palace. It is just one of the pieces of jewellery recorded in 1853 in the Cappella del Palazzo Vescovile di Sua Eccellenza Reverentissima nella città Valletta. A portrait of Bishop Alphéron de Boussan wearing the spectral cross can be seen nowadays at the Auberge d'Aragon. There are other portraits, other extant portraits of Alphéron. One is in Imdina, another is in a local private collection in Valletta, and they all show the spectral cross. This is, of course, the one on the right. Jewellery was also to be found in the churches of Valletta, sometimes donated by the knights and quite frequently offered by the pious Maltese as ex-voto gifts. This jewellery ended up adorning statues and paintings, or it was mutilated in order to be fixed onto chalices and reliquaries. Now, the late Dr. Jimmy Farrugia wholeheartedly condemned this practice. Of course, he is right. It is a desecration of a beautiful piece of silverware to have it studded with unrelated jewels. But I must confess, from the point of view of a jewelry historian, I am rather glad this happened, as it unwittingly conserved historic jewelry, which would otherwise have been lost, melted down, or even sold on. Now, the overall theme of this series of lectures is about Valletta, so I have spoken about where jewelry could be found in Valletta. But jewellery is not made to adorn a house or a building. Jewellery is intended to be worn on the person. Now, I could ramble on at length about what jewellery was being worn by the different classes of persons at different periods, what the knights wore, what the ecclesiastics wore, what the townsfolk and peasants wore. But to stick to the theme of this lecture, yes, the best jewellery, the most artistic pieces of jewellery, and the most precious would very likely have been worn in Valletta. Sometimes one has to rely on contemporary portraits to gauge what was being worn, particularly by the upper crust. This is because jewellery, especially that belonging to individuals, tends to be reset according to the fashion of the times. Inventories also help tremendously to shed light on what was being worn. A lot does, however, survive. In fact, throughout the course of my research, I have found churches, whether originally pertaining to the Order of St. John, to the diocese, or to the monastic orders, to be particularly rich sources of jewellery. The inventories of the conventual church contain descriptions of several pieces of jewellery. Centuries later, give or take a Napoleon or two, few actual jewellery pieces survive in the conventual church in particular. But let me show you one of the most splendid pieces at St. John's. It is a gold morse, as you can see, decorated with colourful cloisonné enamels, pearls and gems. A morse is an essentially ecclesiastic item of jewellery, intimately related to the church rite. It is used to fasten the cope. Originally, it was held to be 18th century, but I think that we can safely say it is at least early 17th century, with some later additions. very likely made in continental Europe. Possibly we can narrow that down to South Germany. No marks appear on it, so we can't ever know for sure. Now here is a personal favorite of mine. This is what I have dubbed the Passalacqua chain. It belongs to the confraternity of the Virgin of Charity of the Carmelite Church in Valletta. Apart from its obvious beauty and considerable artistic qualities, the most exciting thing was discovering its provenance. The friars of Tal Carmelo allowed me to go through the archives of the confraternity, and I chanced upon an extract from the will of a major benefactor of this confraternity, a certain Cesare Passalacqua. I then tracked down his 1683 will in the acts of notary Pietro Attod at the notarial archives, and this is what I found. By means of a legacy contained in his 1683 will, Cesare Passalacqua left the chain, together with a pair of golden bracelets set with pearls and cameos. Unfortunately, the bracelets have not been traced. And he donated them to the Veneranda Confraternita di Nostra Signora del Carmine. Certain conditions were attached to the legacy, namely that the chain and bracelets could not be alienated in any manner, and they were to be placed on the statue of the Virgin on her feast day and on other giorni solenni. The chain remained in the possession of the confraternity, probably undergoing the additions of the pendant and the black velvet backing at some unknown later date. So the original chain was literally just the necklace, the pendant, which is made up of a cross and a lobed design studded with colorless stones, are completely separate. They are old as well, they are possibly of the same period, but they were unrelated to the chain. They were added on later on. Other documents in the archive of the confraternity indicated that on the arrival of the French in Malta, the chain was probably buried together with all the silverware pertaining to the confraternity in a grave in the church and retrieved after their departure. Luckily, it's still around. This chain is clearly a luxury item of exquisite workmanship. Although a source of origin for the style and production of this chain has yet to be satisfactorily proven, it is worth noting that comparable examples are present in Malta and in neighbouring Sicily. The use of openwork curlicues, for example, has been noted in Sicilian examples. A large enamelled chain mounted on the reliquary bust of St. Agatha in the Cathedral of Catania in Sicily is quite close, particularly in the manner the jewels are mounted in elaborate settings, placed in the centre of each link. As I said, the other elements are extraneous to the original chain, as is also the black velvet backing with gold braid. I know it shows the necklace off beautifully, but originally they did not have this backing. But I think that it was probably added on to function as a support for the entire chain, because the chain is actually quite heavy, and some of the links had come apart with time. So really it was a prudent decision to actually put black velvet backing behind it. Another splendid piece of jewellery. This is conserved in one of the parishes of Valletta, which will remain unmentioned. It is a gemmed and enamelled brooch, probably made in continental Europe and dating to the late 17th or early 18th century, although it does have some later additions. This type is known as a bonnet or Sévigné, after the Marquis de Sévigné, who was a member of the court of Louis XIV. Its jewelled and enamelled surface recalls the pioneering mid-17th century designs of Gilles Lajar. However, it has been proposed that the central element of this brooch could be much later. The shell motifs which surround the central stone are more reminiscent of a Rococo design rather than the earlier Baroque motif of the gemmed ribbon itself. This brooch could perhaps be incomplete as it does not have a pendant attached in the centre below. The twisted cord design running along the length of each loop has Spanish parallels, themselves derived from Lajar designs. And these parallels are in the designs sketched in the late 17th century in the collection of the Vic Museo Episcopal. In Spain, the bonnet brooch was known as Lazo and reached the height of its popularity in the 1680s. where did this particular piece come from? Unfortunately, in this case, I can't give you a definite answer, only a suggestion. A strong verbal tradition holds that a noble Maltese family, generous patrons of this church, donated this refined piece of jewellery out of gratitude for the improvement in health of an important family member. Nothing else can be said, and more research is called for. What of the private collections? One particular private collection in Valletta boasts a number of exquisite pieces. Here are some photos of jewellery typically worn by Maltese ladies in the past. The photo of the painting on the right is, the painting is actually a detail from a painting which is in the Casa Rocca Piccola collection. The earrings on the left belong to another private collection in Valletta. But that is very typical of what sort of jewellery was circulating in late 18th century, perhaps even early 19th century in Malta. Gold filigree encrusted with tiny seed pearls. Very, very, very typical of Maltese jewellery. Also very popular in other places around the Mediterranean, particularly Sicily. The use of coral, which was present in abundance in Maltese and Sicilian waters, is predominant. I'll tell you something interesting about coral. Now, the closest place where coral was worked and was really renowned, the workmanship in coral was renowned, is in Trapani on the west coast of Sicily. And in fact, the work that emerged from there is unbelievably beautiful. Particularly, they used to adorn copper or copper gilt frames, for example, and designs in relief. And they used to highlight these designs with little, like, teardrops of coral. Plus, they used to sculpt coral branches into little, even devotional pieces. And the reason for this is that in the waters near Trapani, there are coral fields, basically, in the waters. Now, so we, at one stage, were thinking that most of the coral was coming from Sicily, but we know that coral is present in abundance in around Maltese waters. Now, what was really, really interesting was, I found two petitions in the 18th century, which were presented to the order by a number of corallari from Trapani. There were about 25 named corallari. Corallari are the persons who fish coral, asking for the Grand Master's permission, as was the case, you'd ask for the Grand Master's permission. That's the typical standard phraseology, I suppose, of petitions, where they were asking to actually fish coral from Maltese waters, which I thought was unusual, because we thought that they would have been sourcing all their coral from the area around Trapani. So clearly, Maltese coral was of very high quality and was richer cut, you know, was very much in demand. Now, the use of coral is much beloved of the Maltese. Also, the use of gold and the use of tiny seed pearls, as I have mentioned. Now, this particular piece, its importance is not so much in its intrinsic value, which is negligible, or its antiquity, which is impossible to determine, but in its folkloric value. The clenched fist motif was well known in Latin countries and was held to have powerful properties capable of shielding its wearer against the evil eye. More so, exactly, either the mano cornuta or even the higa or the fica, which is a bit vulgar, but frankly it was used even, it was actually attached to rosaries at times. So it was really believed to turn away the evil eye. Coral was believed to keep the devil away from you, so even children are always bedecked in coral jewellery. And this belief, sometimes you actually hear people still saying, like, roll, coral is still held to somehow protect you. Of course, I can't not mention the Barbat Salt al Gran Spinat. For those unfamiliar with the type, it is a very long, fancy link gold chain. Each link is mounted with gold granules, forming a floret or star shape on each visible facet. In recent centuries, it was used by church prelates and monsignors in a very long format to suspend the pendant cross from it. The number of granules on each link varies from necklace to necklace, with the finest being the ones containing the most granules, and the ones held in highest esteem being the ones having hammered granules, which are slightly flattened on top. Although most examples are known in gold, some examples are known in silver, base metal, and even pinchbeck. Pinchbeck is an imitation gold. It was invented, if I'm not mistaken, towards the 18th century to imitate gold, but it's an alloy. It is known in Malta, it was known very much in England, but it is known in Malta. In fact, in inventories, I have found a few, very few references to pinchbeck. They somehow pronounced it as pinchbeck locally. Sometimes buttons and other items of jewellery were adorned with the granulation technique and would then also be referred to as grand spinat. Now, unusually, considering its prevalence in Malta, this type of necklace is virtually unknown in nearby Sicily, and the source of origin for its style should be sought elsewhere. Now, Priscilla Muller, the leading expert on historic Spanish jewellery, has suggested that this type of chain actually originates from the East and was eventually introduced to Europe through Portugal and Spain. Another curiosity is that although exemplars of grand spinat exist in foreign collections, the origin of the term grand spinat, or grand spinal as it is sometimes called in Malta, appears to be unknown outside Malta. No specific references to grand spinat was encountered generally in the Knights Period documents consulted during the course of my research. Some references were, however, found to similar sounding words like agrano depinar and alespinasse, which might possibly be corruptions of the term or even the origin of the term grand spinat. Giovanni Bonello has also noted other variants, namely catenetta d'oro fatta a spinace and catena d'oro a grana di spinaccio, which he interprets as the origin of the term grand spinat. It is also possible that the term gained popular currency locally after the Knights period, but actually referred to a type of necklace which may already have been present in Malta prior to 1798, but referred to under another name, such as Fattura di Portogallo. I'm working on this hypothesis because I know, for example, of a necklace which is found in association with the cross of Alfarán de Busan, which is a grand spinat necklace. In the inventories, in the 18th century inventories, which referred to this donation of Alfarán de Busan to the cathedral church, the donation of the cross and other items of jewellery, a necklace of a Fattura di Portogallo was donated also to the cathedral church along with this cross. So if we're still talking about the same necklace, but there's no proof of that, because necklaces can be very, very easily removed from a pendant, but if that same necklace happened to be the one that is now in association with the actual cross, then we might have solved this problem. A Fattura di Portogallo might possibly be what is now known as grand spinat. Hopefully I'll find some sort of answer eventually, but I'm looking. In general, local museums have very few pieces of jewellery in their collections. Palazzo Falzon in Imdina has a small but very significant collection of jewellery and dress accessories. Here in Valletta, I would single out the wonderful Casa Rocca Piccola, a private museum I never ever tire of visiting, which has some good pieces of jewellery on display. In fact, this devotional enamel and filigree pendant is in a Sicilian tradition which harks back to at least the late 17th century, and it is in the collection of the Casa Rocca. The pendant, which consists of a frame of silver filigree, surrounds a painted enamel medallion with a representation of the Madonna della Lettera on the obverse and St. Agatha on reverse. The medallion is clearly Sicilian, or heavily influenced by Sicilian enamels, since it depicts devotions which were particularly strong in Sicily. Moreover, the painting on the medallion depicting the Madonna della Lettera, a devotion which is associated particularly with Messina, appears almost identical to an extant Sicilian medallion attributed to late 17th early 18th century Sicilian workmanship. These types of filigree framed miniatures of religious subjects survive in relatively large quantities, and this indicates that they were produced on a significant scale in the past, and their use was widespread. In nearby Sicily, these types of medallions depicting a variety of saints are very well known and seem to have emerged first from the bottega of the famous Giuseppe Bruno, the enamelist from Messina, but then continued being made till at least the early 18th century. It is very probable that in Malta, these types of pendants were attached to the extensions of rosaries due to their devotional subject and due also to the fact that they were used likewise in Sicily. Let me finish with an appeal which has nothing to do with Valletta. There are currently several adverts appearing in newspapers to trade in one's unwanted gold jewellery for money. This is because of the astronomical prices that gold is currently fetching on international markets. But in doing so, people may unwittingly be handing in old pieces of jewellery which may have important historical value. These will either be melted down and therefore entirely destroyed, or else if the dealers acquiring this jewellery are savvy enough, they will realise its true historic value and sell it on at a much higher price, probably on foreign markets. Whatever the case, an important part of the Maltese patrimony will be lost forever. So please, if you are considering trading in your old jewellery pieces, please first consult with a reputable local jeweller. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Our jewelry is taken to other countries, and it's serious such a shame. And like you said, I mean, they can get the same price probably from a local jewelry, and at least the old jewelry will be still in our country. It really is a shame.
What really worries me is that it might be melted down. It's bad enough that it's going to be taken abroad and might disappear in somebody's private collection, but at least it will have survived in some way or another. The worst thing is if it's melted down. I mean,
and probably they auction them and they get far more than as well from what they give to the people.
Is one of the problems is that nothing as such has been written. You know, again, there has not yet been a focused study on jewellery. So people perhaps are not as aware that jewellery might have a greater value. This is why my appeal is, you know, go straight to a reputable jeweller, and our jewellers do know. I mean, they can assess easily, either from the marks, but many times hallmarks don't appear very clearly on jewellery. This is one of the problems that one encounters when you try and study jewellery history. When you examine the objects, very often you don't find the mark, or the mark is only partially visible, or it's abraded. But still, a local jeweller who has handled a lot of jewellery, possibly over decades, would be able to tell whether it is something that is, you know, that can be easily melted down because it was mass produced in the 1980s, or if it is a very good piece that would be a great big pity if it were melted down. So, spread the word. It might very well be, as I mentioned, Priscilla Muller, who is an expert on Spanish jewellery, I had consulted her about it, because, again, for example, Spanish jewellery historians weren't able to tell me anything about Sicilian ones weren't able to tell me anything about Gran Spinat, which I found strange, because us being so close to Sicily, and we derive so much influence in terms of all areas of art, even jewellery, and they had nothing in Sicily which resembles Gran Spinat. This is why I looked further afield and checked with Spain, and this expert told me she knows about it. She knows about the Gran Spinat chains in the Philippines, and she thinks that possibly the origin was from the east, coming to Portugal and Spain. Of course, Portugal had colonies in the east. Portugal itself was sending out its expert craftsmen to the east to work the jewellery in the east and then have them have items exported to Portugal. So yes, it could be that the influence flowed from there, and then it could very easily have come to Malta in terms of, first of all, there was a lot of trade with Portugal and Spain. The Maltese traders, you know, were, you know, other people will explain better, other historians will explain better about trade, maritime trade. So there was a very strong contact with, you know, along the Spanish coast and possibly with Portugal also. There was a strong contingent of Portuguese knights in Malta. Plus, jewellery is extremely portable, so it's very easily carried all over the place. So yes, it is a possibility. And I'm still not convinced. I still need to see more museums in Sicily and examine other collections. But I can tell you that, for example, the most recent publications and very, very thorough publications on Sicilian jewellery don't have anything remotely resembling Grand Spinat. And yet, Portuguese, yes. For example, there are some catalogues of the Order of St. John. Occasionally, the Order of St. John organises some wonderful exhibitions where they collect together artefacts which have some sort of connection with the Order. And, for example, ones that were held in Portugal and in Spain, exhibitions of this sort, actually had a lot of pieces which had jewellery, you know, which had the Grand Spinat technique. Yes, there was a bequest which included fob watches and accessories to Fine Arts, the Fine Arts Museum, but again, not a lot of jewellery, it's more accessories, quasi-quasi. With, for example, fob watches don't fall within the scope of my studies. In fact, there's a study which is separate for fob watches, and other dress accessories like filigree hair combs and this sort of thing. Then there's Palazzo Falson, which has the collection of Captain Golcher. And yes, there is quite a bit of jewellery and some interesting pieces, like, for example, mourning jewellery. Mourning jewellery is jewellery, literally, which is created to commemorate the passing of a loved one. Very, very popular in Victorian England, for example, but even earlier. For example, the will of William Shakespeare had within it, and this was common. I'm just mentioning William Shakespeare because we all know who he is. But it had, one of the provisions it had within it was that he left some money for rings to be made, to be worn by particular people in his memory. So this was a very common thing. So Palazzo, to go back to what I was saying, Palazzo Falfon, for example, has some mourning rings. Other collections. I would have expected to find more at Fine Arts, for example, but the focus of that collection and even the philosophy of collecting in that particular museum was more focused on the fine arts, as in on paintings and sculpture, furniture as well, but not so much jewellery. Casa Rocca, of course, has, you know, a very good collection of jewellery. I don't know what sort of budget they have to do so. Again, it all boils, yeah. It's a very good point. One of the problems is that there isn't published literature about jewellery, so unless you conduct the study yourself, you're not quite sure what is perhaps a piece worth acquiring or whether it's worth what is the asking price. Well, evaluate, yes. I mean, the local jewellers can, because they know, because they do sell old pieces, so more or less there will be an indication, and the auction houses as well do occasionally sell antique jewellery. I will be publishing, well, this is a small fraction of the entire study that I prepared in my MA dissertation, and I will be publishing it in book form, hopefully towards the end of this year. But as I tell you, I've just started to scrape the surface. There's a lot more to be done. I completely agree with you. I have looked at Carmelo Vassallo's book, which talks about specifically this trade that was going on with Spain and the cotton and currencies as well were very important because there isn't any mention of jewellery, which I thought was strange. No, but it is a form of value, of bringing back some sort of value back to the island. Yes, and the thing, the great thing about jewellery is that you can hide it on your person, so if there's any chance, it's a very important consideration when you're attempting a sea journey. Yes, absolutely, but this is very important, something like that we have to record, again, for the folkloric dimension of jewellery. I have looked at registers of what was being brought into Malta, and again, jewellery doesn't feature, but if we're looking at private gifts, then it's a... Exactly, or it's something you don't quite declare. There are records. I had looked at some records even at Santo Spirito, which is the archive in Rabat, National Archive in Rabat. unfortunately, there are quantities, but there aren't any descriptions of jewellery. What it talks about is quantities and weights of silver and gold. So that didn't give me enough information. But and then there are other, you know, other sources which do give you some sort of description of jewellery which was taken away. For example, again, the famous Lorient episode. Goodness knows what was blown up in Aboukir Bay. Very likely there were a lot of jewellery pieces. In fact, in underwater excavations, they have found some pieces. For example, they found a silver thimble, which was Maltese, and some buckles as well. But I don't believe that there has been a very thorough underwater exploration of the wreck yet. Okay, so it's not, it wasn't actually on the vessel by that. He had already unloaded it. Yeah, okay. In fact, Testa says that. Testa says very likely a lot had been removed already.
Please, may I warn on a very sad story? My wife is quite sick today. She couldn't come and she told me the most lectures wanted to. But I know, I am happy that she didn't come. Because she has had a story, what you have said. It happened about a year ago, all these, you know, adverts on the Times. And she took with her two pairs of earrings like those, exactly like those, bell-shaped, big like this, paper knife with Deroan also, knit, and bracelets and whatnot. In any case, she was given the beautiful sum by these famous, now of 200 Malta lire. Then she, but on the condition that you exchange it. She got a very thin white gold bracelet for this 200, and I told her all this treasure, you're going to leave it for just this thing. And until this day, she is crying what she has lost. And it was of her grandmother, this. Oh. But she said, they are old, they are not fashionable. And she was really taken, not for a ride, I think, but something.
Yeah, let's bring them back into fashion. Let's wear them.
No, I don't think they melted them, because they are museum pieces. Museum.
What a pity.
No, museum pieces. And another part about grand spinach. You know, in Malta, we have an account creating or inventing etymologically some words for us, like about my Maltese, Dar Maltia, Saliatura, and Galleria, which the English and Italian don't understand, but it's a Maltese concoction. But I think Gran Spinat might come from the word, it's a Maltese, from spina. Spina is a point, you know, pointed, torn. Mm. And it might be that those tiny things are the point of a spina, they are so delicate. It might be the Maltese invented this because they are so delicate and small that they might be the point of a spina, of a thorn. A spina is very similar. It might be a Maltese invention.
In fact, that's why they're so greatly appreciated, because the technique is so hard. It's so difficult.
Their eyesight must have been wonderful.
Mind you, it comes from the origin of, not grand spina, of granulation. It lies in the past, in the distant past. But. it wasn't, I know about them, I've heard about them, I've seen one or two pieces, not many, because they're really jealously guarded. The scope of my studies was the Knights period, so I didn't go beyond that. Hopefully, given time, I'll look into them as well, because there's another great story.
So, I think Francesca, she deserves a clap for her.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society entitled Important Historic Jewelry of Valletta. This talk was delivered by Mrs. Francesca Balzan.